It is Wednesday, August 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump continues his attack on the news media at a rally in Arizona. Today marks the 90th anniversary of the execution of two men who profess their innocence.
This is a time in which, in the United States, there is a significant backlash against immigration.
And singer Pink releases a new single that's shooting up the charts. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump Tuesday night addressed a rally in Phoenix, Arizona, where he said he's willing to risk a budget crisis in order to honor a campaign pledge to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Trump used the Phoenix speech to lash out at the media again for its coverage of his response to the deadly violence at a recent protest organized by neo-Nazis and white supremacists in Charlottesville, Virginia. Trump was broadly criticized for blaming both sides for violence. I spoke to White House correspondent Steve Herman, who attended the Phoenix rally. He told me about Trump's speech.
He devoted a lot of this address to really attacking the media. Now, he's said all of these things before, but to devote such a sizable percentage of his speech and to really drill down on, again, specifically naming certain media outlets for criticism, New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, essentially calling reporters bad people. He stopped one very small step short of essentially regarding the media in the United States as treasonous. And this egged on the crowd, of course, as he likes to do. And there was immediate criticism following the speech, not only from the media, but, for example, from such figures as the former director of national intelligence, James Clapper, who was on CNN, one of the networks that was attacked by name by the president, and Clapper questioning basically the president's fitness for office.
What was the atmosphere like in the hall itself? I believe you were there.
Yes, the president is on social media today claiming that there were 15,000 people in the room. It was nowhere near that. We haven't had a specific estimate because this was technically a private campaign event, but somewhere between 1,000 to 2,000, I would say, were there. He didn't pack the room. All of the seats that had been put out were filled, but there was a lot of empty space on the sides and in the back of the room. And this was a typical Donald Trump crowd. He was playing to the base. People throughout Arizona and from some other states had come into the state to see Trump, their hero. They were very excited to see him, and they got quite the event, which they were expecting. I think also what was very interesting was that Trump injected himself into Arizona politics. He did not name John McCain and Jeff Flake, the two Republican U.S. senators from the state of Arizona, but he did attack them and undermine them, criticizing McCain for his vote defeating the health care legislation. And then this morning on Twitter, he did name Jeff Flake, the junior senator from Arizona. It's widely expected that Trump is going to support a primary opponent to Senator Flake in next year's election. And this really exemplifies this growing divide in the Republican Party, the president's party, some even calling it a civil war in the party itself, pitting the establishment Republicans against the Trump supporters.
He also talked about building a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, which, of course, is of great, I would think, great interest in Arizona.
Yes. Again, this has been a centerpiece of not only his campaign, but his presidency. He's talked seriously about the wall having solar panels on it. And before he did come to Phoenix, he was in Yuma, Arizona, at the border, and visited with the Customs and Border Protection people there. And that is definitely going to continue to be a centerpiece of his presidency, so much to the point that last night he threatened a government shutdown if there wasn't adequate funding in the budget that the senators will bring forward at some point this year for him to sign.
Now, there were protesters outside the center there. What happened in regards to them?
There were a small number of Trump supporters that were protesting, but most of the people that were on the streets for a good period of the evening were around the Phoenix Convention Center were just lined up peacefully to get into the facility to see President Trump. They were taunted by some thousands of protesters who oppose the president's policy. It did get heated at times. We did not see any clashes, any fights breaking out. However, at one point, police felt compelled to fire some pepper balls and tear gas, saying that there were some protesters that were throwing things at them. But for the most part, it was peaceful. But after what happened in Charlottesville, there was tremendous scrutiny on what was going on here last night in Phoenix. And there were fears that some significant violence could erupt. This is an open carry state. I did see a couple of people carrying their guns. And we should also point out that the mayor of Phoenix had asked the president not to hold this rally, that it was too soon after Charlottesville, that feelings were very raw across the country, not only here in Arizona, and that the president would pour gasoline on the fuel of hatred, as the mayor said.
That's White House correspondent Steve Herman reporting from Phoenix, Arizona. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
With all that political contentiousness we just heard about, we actually, for once, have a story of bipartisanship and political camaraderie. And this starts with the conservative website The Daily Caller, who put up an article that was titled, "It's High Time Barron Trump Starts Dressing Like He's in the White House," referring to President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump's child, Barron, and the clothes that he's been wearing when he's been seen in the public. He's dressed in T-shirts and shorts, like any 10 or 11-year-old would be. Well, someone weighing in who knows full well what it's like to be under that scrutiny, Chelsea Clinton, the former President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, their daughter, she tweeted out in response to this article and said, "It's high time the media and everyone leave Barron Trump alone and let him have the private childhood he deserves." Of course, she grew up before our eyes when she was in the Clinton White House as a teenager, so she knows the feeling full well. Well, Melania Trump, First Lady Melania Trump, responded to this saying, "Thank you, Chelsea Clinton. So important to support all of our children in being themselves." And then hashtag stop childhood bullying, which has been her big cause in the White House. So people saying this is a nice moment of bipartisanship on social media. Maybe there is some political discourse left in the United States. And both sides agreeing that children should be off limits, children of politicians. Focus on their parents and the activities that they do, not the children themselves.
Yeah, they often did not ask to be in the White House.
No, they did not. They're along for the ride. And I know you're about to have a story about an anniversary, but today on social media, there's a big anniversary because on August 23rd, 2007, 10 years ago, was the first hashtag. It was when Chris Messina sent out a tweet asking, "What if we used a pound symbol to organize different groups on the internet?" And from there, it has just gone off. One stat I saw, Sarah, 125 million hashtags used across all social media platforms every day.
Wow.
So gives you some scope of how much this has changed how we communicate online and how ubiquitous it is across all of the internet.
Absolutely is. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The United States withholds aid from Egypt over human rights concerns. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley discusses the Iran deal with the U.N. nuclear watchdog chief. Russia puts a prominent theater director under house arrest, and a U.N. panel appeals to the U.S. to reject racially motivated crimes. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. A new study found that the Zika virus, which has been linked to miscarriages and congenital birth defects like microcephaly, weakens a pregnant woman's already compromised immune system. The study by researchers at the University of Southern California suggests that the virus suppresses the body's defenses by targeting white blood cells. This allows the virus to spread, which increases the chances that a pregnant woman's baby will be harmed. Jay Jung, senior author of the study, says the Zika virus stunts a woman's natural defenses in a way that almost resembles HIV. Pregnancy itself already weakens the immune system so that the body doesn't reject the developing fetus, which it sees as a foreign object. The World Health Organization says Zika is spread by infected mosquitoes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear singer Pink with her new single, What About Us? Today marks the 90th anniversary of the deaths of shoemaker Nicola Sacco and fishmonger Bartolomeo Vanzetti by execution. The two Italian immigrants were convicted of robbing and killing two men in the Boston, Massachusetts area in 1920. The case became an international sensation and sparked widespread protests. Moshe Temkin is a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School and author of the book The Sacco-Vanzetti Affair, America on Trial. I spoke with him about the case and how it resonates today.
The context is really important. So it took place right at about the time, starts in 1920. That's when they're arrested. In 1921 is when they're put on trial. This is a time in which in the United States, there is a significant backlash against immigration and also against foreign influence and what is considered to be, you know, subversive influence from abroad after World War One. And so Sacco and Vanzetti, who were accused of being criminals, accused of banditry, turns out they were anarchists. And being anarchists and Italian immigrants made them target for a lot of hostility. So it became clear to at least a lot of observers that there were a lot of problems with their trial because of how politics and this kind of context got mixed up with the criminal case itself. So they protested their innocence really strenuously, and a lot of people came to believe that they were indeed innocent. And so first it became an issue in Massachusetts where the trial took place, then it became an issue nationally, and then eventually internationally.
What kind of evidence was there against them, and why was it controversial?
Well, there actually was not a lot of evidence. Most of the evidence was circumstantial. The money that they were accused of having was never recovered. They themselves did not have a criminal record. The prosecution relied a lot on what they called consciousness of guilt, the way that they behaved when they were first interrogated by police. But we have to take into account that Sacco and Vanzetti were not English speakers at the time. They had reasons to fear the police because people of their background were being rounded up, mostly for deportation. And also the prosecution made an issue of their political background and their political beliefs, which had nothing to do with the crime at hand. So that's another reason why this became a very controversial case at first.
And when they were eventually sentenced to be executed, there were a lot of protests about this. The poet Edna St. Vincent Millay wrote a poem. She also, I believe, wrote to the governor of Massachusetts. And yet the executions proceeded. And I believe both men wrote as well about this themselves.
They were convicted by the jury in 1921, and they were only executed in August 23, 1927. That's why we're having the 90th year anniversary now of their execution. In between, their case, you know, which started as a local criminal case in Boston, had become, by 1927, you know, the most famous case in the world, an affair, a scandal, if you will. There were protests and riots and demonstrations. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of people who wrote in to the governor of Massachusetts, to the president of the United States, you know, asking to not execute Sacco and Vanzetti, but, you know, protesting that they were innocent people who were railroaded for a crime they didn't commit. By 1927, when they were executed, Sacco and Vanzetti were arguably two of the most famous people in the world. They had gone from being completely obscure, anonymous immigrants who nobody knew who they were to being extremely famous. And another reason why they were famous is because of how eloquent they were, right? They protested their innocence in the courtroom in very powerful terms. They corresponded with many people, including famous people, intellectuals. And they impressed a lot of people, right? People thought, hey, these guys are not bandits. They, you know, they were anarchists. Maybe people didn't like the way they thought about society and so on. But there was just a sense that of a gap, an intolerable gap between who they were, their personas, and the crime for which they had been convicted and were being executed for.
And I believe that there, at the time of the funeral procession afterwards, this was a huge event in Boston.
Yes, it was a mass funeral of protest and kind of a march down the streets of Boston that took place under heavy police guard. At the time, Boston, Massachusetts, was a very different city from what it is today. Right today, it has this reputation of kind of being a liberal bastion, a more multicultural city. At the time, its reputation was much more conservative and hostile to immigrants and other ethnic groups. And so people came to Boston to march for Sacco and Vanzetti, their funeral procession, under heavy, heavy police guard. And it was a very, very tense moment in Boston history. I should also add that when they were executed, the immediate reaction in many places around the world actually was violence, riots, demonstrations, attacks on American institutions, American tourists who were traveling in Western Europe and Latin America and other places. So yeah, it was a very significant date.
And what do you think this case 90 years ago, how does this speak to the United States now, at the present time?
Oh, I think it resonates in many ways. We have, all your listeners know, we have ongoing debates over immigration, right? How the United States treats its immigrants, who is considered to be an American, who is considered to be not a so-called real American, right?
Moshik Temkin, professor at the Harvard Kennedy School. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. A pop princess has issued a new single, and here to tell me about it is VOA's Border Crossings host, Larry London.
So today we're focusing on a singer named Pink, and she is outrageous, she's outspoken, and she's kind of a very talented, very in-your-face performer, singer who's had a lot of success with a number of hits over the years, So What?, and, you know, she had a big hit with Lady Marmalade about over 10 years ago, I guess, with Christina Aguilera and a number of other singers. And now she's back with a new album after a five-year hiatus. The last album that Pink has had out was 2012. So she's back with a new album, and as Pink would have it, she's releasing it on Friday the 13th.
Oh!
October the 13th. And her new album is called Beautiful Trauma. And she just put out a brand new song, which is rising up the charts very, very quickly. So we're going to check it out today. Here's Pink and a song called What About Us?
We are searchlights we can see in the dark. We are rockets pointed up at the stars.
What is the theme behind this new album and single?
Well, there isn't necessarily a theme behind the album, which we won't know until we see all the songs on the album. which don't come out until the album's released October 13th. But as far as the first song goes, it's a power ballad. All of Pink's songs, as she ages, and she's 37 now, seem to have more significance, more meaning. She used to sing about parties and fun stuff, and now it's taking a little bit of a darker turn. Now she's a mom. She's got a 6-year-old daughter named Willow and a 1-year-old son whose name is Jameson, who was born a year ago with her husband Carrie Hart of the past 11 years. So she's kind of taken a more serious view towards what she writes and put out. Last year, she put out a country song that was nominated for several awards. But this year, she's back now with the new pop song. I watched the video, which just came out, and a lot of it takes place on prison grounds. It's kind of interesting. There's a lot of prison scenes. There's the typical in the car driving around scenes. She's got a strange looking hairdo. I don't know. She's curled and put it in a bun on the top of her head. So, you know, it's an interesting video. I like the song. And I would also like to say congratulations a little bit early to Pink, who on this coming up Sunday will be the recipient of an award that has been given to Rihanna, Beyonce, Madonna, Britney, quite a few others. It's called the Michael Jackson Video Vanguard Award, which will be handed out at the MTV Video Music Award show in California this Sunday. And she's going to get it this year.
Sounds very impressive.
It is impressive. MTV says the award is handed out because Pink has been a trailblazer and made an impact on music, pop culture, fashion, and philanthropy. And she's scheduled to perform. And over her career, Pink has won 3 Grammys, 7 MTV Awards, and she was named the 2009 Billboard Pop Sound Artist of the Decade. And she always makes it to Forbes' richest, highest-paid celebrities. Even though she hasn't put anything out in a long time, she averages about $30 million a year. And she's been on the VH1 Greatest Artist of All Time. So she's obviously been around for a while. She just did a festival show in Berlin, Germany 2 weeks ago. She performed alongside of a good friend of hers, Alanis Morissette. And so with the new album, I'm sure that Pink will have a tour. It's been a while, but we'll be excited because she puts on great shows. She swings from a trapeze, from the ceiling. She, you know, does so many things and dances. When she was growing up, she was a gymnast. So she's very fit. And it's always fun to watch Pink in concert. The new album is called Beautiful Trauma, and the new song is What About Us?
All right, thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. What about us? What about us? And that's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The governments of France, the United Kingdom, and the United States welcome the recent announcement by the Libyan National Army, or LNA, that it will investigate reports of unlawful killings in Benghazi. The LNA has recognized the arrest warrant by the International Criminal Court prosecutor for a member of the LNA, Major Mahmoud Mustafa Bouseif Al-Werfali, and has suspended him pending an investigation. The United States calls on the LNA to ensure that the investigation is carried out fully and fairly, and those responsible for the unlawful killings are held to account. Al-Werfali, a senior Libyan military commander, stands accused by the International Criminal Tribunal judges of personally shooting or ordering the execution of 33 people who were either civilians or injured fighters in at least 7 incidents in 2016 and 2017. Major Al-Werfali is loyal to strongman Khalifa Haftar, a former general under longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Haftar heads the most powerful military in Libya, and his forces recently managed to retake Benghazi after a 3-year campaign against other militant groups. The U.S. is monitoring ongoing acts of conflict in Libya closely. Those suspected of committing, ordering, or failing to prevent unlawful killings and torture on all sides must be fully investigated and held accountable. The U.S. and its allies will continue efforts at the international level to pursue appropriate action against those who are complicit in violations of international human rights law or international humanitarian law, whatever their affiliation. It is in Libya's interest to be able to rely on unified security forces responsible for the country's security and acting within the framework of Libya's laws and respecting international law. The governments of France, the United Kingdom, and the United States also reaffirm their support for the Government of National Accord. We underscore the importance of the United Nations' central role in facilitating Libyan-led political dialogue. Welcome the appointment of the new special representative of the Secretary General, Ghassan Salamé, and look forward to supporting his efforts to facilitate a political solution in Libya.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.